Welcome to this special edition of the Minor Consult. I recently had the privilege of sitting down with Chelsea Clinton, Vice Chair of the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Health Access Initiative, in front of a live audience. In addition to reliving memories from our time in Arkansas, we discussed pressing global health issues, the critical role of trust and communication in science, and the importance of approaching the world with humility, empathy, and optimism. So without further ado, let's get into our episode. So it's now my pleasure to welcome Chelsea Clinton, Vice Chair of the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Health Access Initiative. Chelsea, of course, has her undergraduate degree from Stanford, and she's been driven by a deep commitment to improving lives and fostering emerging leadership across the United States and around the world. Her initiatives range from promoting early child development with Too Small to Fail, to empowering student leaders through the Clinton Global Initiative University. Not only is Chelsea a formidable advocate for public health, but she's also a celebrated author, with her works inspiring young readers across the globe. Her dedication to health equity and her thoughtful perspectives on global health systems make her a leading voice on these critical issues. As I said, Chelsea's academic journey began right here at Stanford, and it's been marked by a passion for global health, sparked by transformative experiences that she had here as a student and in her other educational endeavors after Stanford. Chelsea, it's a pleasure to welcome you here. Great to see you. Thank you. Great to see you again.
I'm happy to be here. It's always lovely to be back in the Bay Area. I just want to say thank you to everyone at the medical school and everyone here at the Ritz for helping us be well hydrated and hopefully inspired and informed and activated. Having been on the other side of planning events like this, I know they always run the smoothest when there's been an extraordinary amount of work. So just wanted to start with a moment of gratitude and also just to acknowledge how wonderful it is to be here with a fellow Arkansan. And as some of you may know, because you may have been on what I still count as the single most spectacular Zoom interaction of my entire life, was when we had one of our inaugural sort of advisory council meetings for the public health program here at the medical school. At the end of the meeting, Dean Miner said, may I have a personal moment? I said, sure, I had no idea what he was about to say. And he said, do you remember your kindergarten teacher? And I said, of course, Mrs. Miner. And he said, that was my mother. And so,
it's a small world.
it is a small world, and Mrs. Miner does exist in this really special place in my kind of heart and my memory, because by the time I was in kindergarten in the mid 1980s in Little Rock, the Little Rock school district had grown kind of so rapidly that there was not enough extant space in elementary schools for kindergartners. And so I actually went to kindergarten in a high school, at Hall High School. And so kind of imagine this flock of five-year-olds in this sea of teenagers, right? And they just felt big and scary. And so I really just have this memory of Mrs. Miner kind of as our good shepherd in a quite kind of profound but practical sense. So I'm so happy to be here for many reasons, but admittedly, especially because I get to talk to my kindergarten teacher's son.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be back together, and enjoyed our chat in New York, and also have some memories of the first Christmas in the governor's mansion. Yes. After your dad was elected president, which is quite an exciting time. And I remember our daughter, my wife and I's daughter at the time, was 2.5, and we were there mingling. You know, the governor's mansion in Arkansas is not a big room. It's kind of small, actually. And so there are lots of people there, as you might imagine. And you were there, too. And our daughter had this little doll that she dropped. And
Like 2 seconds later, there were about a dozen Secret Service agents, you know, picking up this doll and checking it, and it was indeed a doll. So we still have the doll, by the way, and our granddaughter is now playing with it. So anyway, lots of great stories, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about Arkansas in the context of our conversation. But, you know, you were an undergraduate here at Stanford, and you've spoken and written about your experiences here and some of the readings you did, which helped guide your future education and what you've done now in your leadership roles. Can you tell us about that? First of all, what were your experiences like here, and what was most transformative for you about this environment?
Oh, goodness. Well, I came to Stanford partly because I had been a little kid in the South, and then I'd gone to high school in Washington, D.C., and I wanted to be in a different environment. I wanted to have a different experience. I thought that's what we were supposed to do when we went to college. And so I came to California, much to my parents' chagrin. I have really treasured memories of going on kind of college tours with my mom as we like trundled around what felt like the 28th school, kind of in the mid-Atlantic and Northeast regions, as she tried to kind of sway me toward kind of closer proximity. I am incredibly close to both of my parents and incredibly proud to be their daughter. I also wanted to have a different adventure in life. So I came to Stanford, and I certainly thankfully found that here and have really just extraordinarily kind of rich memories of my time as a student and as a person here. I have very strong friendships. I went to my reunion last year, and it was so fun to see so many of my professors, many of whom actually are still teaching. And to be able to have maintained those relationships has been hugely important to me. I think, though, D-Minor, what you might be referencing is that I read Infections and Inequalities when I was a junior here, and I cold emailed Paul Farmer 3 pages of, you know, thoughts, questions, and critiques, as I think only maybe a 20-year-old at an institution like Stanford can think is a remotely, you know, kind of reasonable thing to do. And he wrote me back. And we started kind of this pen pal relationship. I didn't know at the time that my mother actually had already known Paul because she had recruited Paul and Partners in Health to help support some of the work that she was really spearheading on trying to kind of provide kind of more robust both kind of medical and public health support to countries that were part of the former Soviet Union. And so she had gotten to know Paul through that, effectively saying, like, you're already in Siberia. Why can't you go to Kazakhstan? And they're like, those aren't close, but okay, we'll figure it out. And so fast forward to when my dad was kind of thinking about kind of what to do in his post-presidential life and how to kind of take his capacious heart and brain and networks, you know, and he asked me and, you know, others, what should he do? And I said, well, I think, you know, you did a lot of great things while you were president. Because again, I'm like now the 21-year-old, like Stanford grad, who thinks I should be able to assess in such a ridiculously hubristic way. But I did say, like, but you haven't done enough on AIDS, and you need to do more, and you should start by talking to Paul Farmer. And so thus actually began a really profoundly important relationship between my dad and Paul as they would work together over the next, you know, 20 plus years until his tragic and way too early passing almost 2 years ago. And kind of that work of understanding kind of what was happening kind of around the HIV/AIDS crisis globally and what wasn't happening, you really catalyzed what would become the Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative, and then kind of now today is the Clinton Health Access Initiative. Because at the 2002 Barcelona, the International AIDS Conference in Barcelona, my father kind of, you know, had started with Paul, but now was talking to lots of other people. And along with President Nelson Mandela, you know, decided that they would kind of take the fact that they were no longer in official positions of power, but still were connected to many who were, and that they had, you know, very kind of deep and broad relationships with people in the private sector as well as the not-for-profit sector, you know, to tackle the gross inequity, which feels like a good segue from what the previous conversation was, of kind of the current price dynamics around antiretrovirals in the global south. You know, so as I'm sure many of you know, if you were living here in the Bay Area, you know, 21, 22 years ago, you know, the odds were that you knew your HIV status, the odds were that you were on ARVs, the odds were that you were in some form of supportive care, community-based, probably more likely than not. And if you were in the global south, the odds were that none of that was true. Right? And at the dawn of the millennium, fewer than 10,000 people across sub-Saharan Africa alone were on ARVs, despite the HIV burden being, you know, close to 25 million people at the time. And so, thankfully, I say as a daughter and as a kind of global health person and as a citizen, you know, this is where my father, along with President Mandela, decided to orient kind of their energies. And so today, you know, flash forward, what was, you know, $10,000 per person per year is now less than $60 per person per year. And of the 30 million-ish people across the global south who access antiretrovirals, more than three quarters access them through agreements that my father and the CHAI team helped negotiate. So really proud of that work, and also proud that for my dad, that was then just the challenge of what more can and should we be doing. And so now, you know, more than 140 kind of large-scale, multi-sectoral kind of market-shaping agreements have been stewarded by my dad and the CHAI team on everything from, you know, lowering the cost of point-of-care diagnostics to lowering the cost of rotavirus vaccines to now we're heavily focused on hepatitis, both hepatitis B and hepatitis C, because there's just always more to do.
Absolutely. What are the top issues right now, both in CHAI and Clinton Global Initiative, that you're working on, that you're passionate about, that you feel like both CHAI and also those of us in the academic community can have an impact on through the work that we do?
Well, I do think, I was at, I guess this is like the week of hanging out around like prestigious academic institutions. I was at the Harvard Graduate School of Education yesterday, talking about work that we're doing at Too Small to Fail with many of the researchers at the Harvard School of Ed on trying to better connect those of us who are concerned around climate change's impact on kind of pregnant people and kind of infants and toddlers, kind of from all the different spheres in which we're kind of doing kind of research work, practice work, and advocacy work. You know, we're really focused on trying to help parents better understand kind of why, as an example, extreme heat is a danger for themselves as kind of pregnant people and their children, but also then what can they do about it? Because I think particularly climate change often seems to be sort of the pornography of despair, right? It's just like everything feels so extreme and so overwhelming, and then I worry consequently kind of disempowering and kind of pushing people into kind of just cynicism. And I want people, of course, to be worried because it is very worrying. Like every week we have more research, it's ever worrying. And also to think, oh, I can push my local elected officials to think about porous concrete. I can kind of push my local elected officials to prioritize shade as we are kind of updating our playgrounds. You know, things that might seem incremental, but collectively we think have a, you know, pretty protective effect for kids and families. And so we were at this meeting yesterday trying to understand kind of what is working to help, you know, parents and other caregivers kind of best kind of feel as if the science is informative and activating and not kind of disempowering and disorienting. And what more can and should we be doing with kind of content creators and people who have very large platforms like the parent influencers or kind of folks in Hollywood to try to embed this message so that it's coming from people who are, you know, maybe a little less serious than us, but who have kind of greater kind of narrative, you know, resonance. So I share that because I do think you asked the question about kind of what is the role here of academic medicine, and I worry that because, again, kind of building off of the last panel's conversation and some of what, you know, Rega was sharing is her experience, that it was such an intense time, and that feels like sort of too mild a word for so many of our physicians or nurses or physician scientists over the last few years, that there will be this receding from the public sphere. And I think we need actually people to be even more engaged, particularly with local communities, because we are always learning more about kind of how to best kind of protect and promote health. And I think it's only through trying to better kind of communicate that at a policy level, but also kind of directly to communities, to families, even to kids themselves, that we'll really start to kind of rebuild kind of the trust that I think all of us probably, regardless of where we sit, kind of on the political spectrum, recognize that we desperately need in our country.
You've literally written a book on global health systems, and you think a lot about how impact scales and how we take discoveries, how we take advances and get them into parts of the world that traditionally haven't been benefited or only far too late or much later than they should have been benefited. What are the take-home messages from scaling, and in particular, how do we here as an academic medical center, you know, focused on excellence in research, education, and patient care, how does our work then get scaled to have the type of benefits that you talked about, for example, with HIV therapies and emerging pathogens? But are there some principles that we should keep in mind as we look at our work here?
Well, you know, Dean, I think I'm less presumptuous now than I was as a student here. So I would not tell you kind of what your principles should be. I think you're more well situated to do that than I am. I will say, though, that I think at least, you know, at the foundation, we try very hard to always kind of design in how we'll hold ourselves accountable kind of from the beginning. And I do think more kind of large scale efforts, whether from kind of multilateral institutions or kind of big kind of operating kind of global NGOs like we are, kind of need partners like you to help us really understand kind of what those metrics should be. I mean, even our kind of too small to fail work, which you were kind enough to mention earlier, where we have really tried to meet kind of parents and caregivers here with the resources that they need to be kind of effective first teachers for their children on kind of early language development, early kind of math and numeracy development, and also early social emotional development. You know, we've had now like 16 evaluations on different parts of that project, from building libraries and laundromats. We've built now more than 600 libraries and laundromats because low-income families spend 2 to 4 hours a week in laundromats, so to turn kind of wash time into teaching time. We now have more than 1,300 playgrounds that have shade across the country that prompt parents and other caregivers to turn playtime into teaching time. So things that probably all of us, because we went to institutions like this or are working at institutions like this, know are important. You know, talk to our kids about how many colors do you see on the playground? How many times can you swing on the swing? Like, how many shapes do you see? To really also help give parents and caregivers kind of the confidence of starting, you know, conversations. Also, they're multilingual when that is important in the different places and spaces. We've distributed more than 1 million books kind of through partnerships with diaper banks. And so all of these have really rigorous evaluations alongside them, not admittedly with Stanford, but with NYU, with Emory, with Rice, with Harvard, with others. And so I say that because I think it's something that we're highly focused on. And I think sometimes others are not yet, but I think with partners, you know, like Stanford very much could be. And I do think, too, we're trying to do more in New York City. While I'm very grateful for growing up in Arkansas and loved my time here in the Bay Area, I've lived in New York longer than anywhere else in my life by a significant margin. It very much feels like home. It's where, you know, we are raising our three kids. It's where much of the kind of core foundation team works, although 95% of the people who work with CHAI kind of work in the countries where they're from. Sort of like the back office corpus is in New York, and the kind of coordinating mechanisms often for building and trying to shepherd these big partnerships through CGI and otherwise. And so we had this kind of reckoning, candidly. Like, we hadn't really tried to do anything in New York City. And so now we're one of the core partners for the New York City Birth Health Equity Initiative that the mayor and Commissioner Vasan, our local health commissioner, started. As any of you who are New Yorkers or may have spent time or pay attention to New York, we have a particularly deplorable maternal mortality rates in New York. And while on a national average, a black mother is three times as likely to die as a white mother giving birth, in New York City, it's actually nine times. So we like to think of ourselves as like this bastion of liberal, progressive policies. We have the Health and Hospitals Corporation. We ostensibly have a very robust health safety net. We have some of the most quote unquote generous kind of Medicaid coverage, although I always loathe when generous is used. We're talking about Medicaid because it always feels like we're not even scraping what I think the bare minimum should be. And yet, we have really terrible, on an absolute and relative basis, kind of maternal mortality rates. And not surprisingly, our infant mortality rates have been going up in the last couple of years. So when we've partnered kind of with the city to help bring together, again, this kind of large kind of set of different organizations who either could be or should be working on these challenges. And we're starting in Brooklyn with the goal of trying to cut maternal mortality in half, with a real emphasis on helping better support kind of black birthing people by 2030. And we have more than 40 partners, everyone from the local Catholic Church to our big hospital systems, to the city, to kind of doula and midwife organizations. And so I share that because we are really trying to kind of have the humility of what have we learned has worked around the world that really can and should be urgently kind of at least attempted to put into practice, here at home. And so I would hope too that kind of similar kind of questions and conversations could be happening, across the Stanford landscape, given all of the extraordinary work that is often happening elsewhere, but could have applicability, in our own zip codes closer to home.
I think that's such an important message, and it comes out in your writings and, of course, the work of the foundations and just in what you've said, and that is a focus really on looking forward, on optimism, and on the key concept of humility and empathy. How do you think about, those attributes in a fairly polarized world today? And what do you think, what keeps you going and the people that work with you and Chai and other initiatives in the face of some pretty daunting challenges?
Well, I'll start kind of with the end of your question and then go back to the beginning.
Sure.
Jim Kim, one of Paul Farmer's partners and starting Partners in Health, and then later the head of Dartmouth and then the head of the World Bank, has said something that I've heard him kind of say in different settings that I just think is a better encapsulation than kind of any words that I could put to this sentiment, ethos, and sort of at least kind of the prerogative of how I try to lead my life, that optimism is a moral choice. And I believe that very deeply, that it is a more moral place to be, to think about how we can always be kind of building a more equitable, more sustainable, kind of more inclusive, more joyous world than kind of just accepting the status quo. And so I start with that because whenever I start to feel like the edges of despair, I think, is this productive? Do I want to just be depressed? Or do I want to think, what can I do with my experience, what I know, the people I know, the platforms that I am lucky and humble to have, the kind of sense of we can always hopefully be doing more? Do I want to live with that, or do I want to live with the proverbial or the actual covers over my head? And I think too, as a parent of three kids, it makes it easier for me to be optimistic. I think for some people it actually makes it harder, but for me it makes it easier because I just think, I want to be able to tell them what I did today that hopefully was generative and positive and productive, instead of just thinking like I stared at a wall all day and like thought about the recent like IPCC report and the world's on fire and there's nothing we can do. Like, that's not a great answer to my four-year-old who's like, I learned how to read Spot today. And I'm like, I stared at a wall and I was depressed today. No, like, that's not, I want to say, like, actually, no, I, like, spoke to the people at the World Health Organization about the 75th anniversary, which is coming up in May, and how there needs to be both, like, the storytelling of all that WHO has done that I candidly don't think it's ever gotten enough credit for, and also, like, what should the next 75 years look like? Or I want to say, like, actually, like, here's what we're trying to do here at home in New York City. Like, we're working in Brooklyn. Like, you have friends that live in Brooklyn. Like, let's talk about that. Like, that's the world that I want to live in. But I think you ask another question, which is, how do we try to kind of tell stories that are rooted in kind of evidence and science that help more of us feel that way, and more of us feel like we are kind of in the work of building a better world for our children kind of together. And I think about this again a lot as a parent, and I was actually thinking about this in the previous conversation when kind of Reka made her offhanded comment about bleach. Because, like, I was aware of the anti-vaccine movement, and I was aware of kind of the profit motives behind it. But I hadn't really paid a lot of attention to it until I was pregnant with my first child. It's like 2014. And it was after the third person came up to me, because, like, I live in the world of New York City. I have, like, no interest in living in, like, in a hermetic, sealed box. Like, I take the subway. I walk a lot. I take the bus. It's like, I live in the world. So after the third person came up to me with just fervor and said, you know, Chelsea, I watched you grow up. Like, I love your family. And I just, like, I hope you're not going to vaccinate your child. And I was like, so the first time I was like, oh, that's kind of odd. And the second time I was like, well, that's a little worrying. And the third time I was like, wow, there is something, and this, like, there is something that has percolated without enough, like, perception to it that is deeply worrying. Because I would think, like, if trust, it's kind of, it's either, like, clean water and sanitation or vaccines, right? If trust and, like, the greatest public health achievements, and I love Alexander Fleming, so I'm nothing against, like, antibiotics. But if we look at just, like, the raw numbers of, like, whose lives have been saved, right, if trust in that has been broken, I was like, what else is going to come? And I tried to talk to people about it, and maybe the moral is I should have been talking to kind of more people in places like this about, like, why I was so worried. I was like, this is a harbinger. Like, what? And I couldn't get anyone really to pay attention. They're like, oh, like, Chelsea, it's just idiosyncratic to you. People come up and talk to you about all sorts of things. That is true. And people come up and, like, talk to me about why they're frustrated with the MTA. And I'm like, I have no power over the MTA. Like, I don't know. Right? I mean, people come up and talk to me about all sorts of things. And I was like, no. I was like, there's something different. There's something different. There's something different here. And we saw what happened, obviously, in 2015 in Texas and elsewhere. And clearly, there is so much, you know, mis and disinformation, much of which I do believe has its origins in kind of somewhat nefarious or certainly not kind of public good ground. And so I'm going to kind of segue back to what I started with. Either we can think, like, this is so depressing. Oh my gosh, like, why do so many people believe things that there's no evidence for? Like, there's no public health evidence. There's not even really anything they can point to as, like, anecdotal. Like, does anyone know anyone who can actually say, like, yes, like, bleach cured me from COVID? Right? So it's an odd dynamic because there isn't a tether to a story, really. It's a feeling. And it's probably actually lots of feelings. So we can either think, oh my goodness, like, how did we get so decoupled from the broad-based understanding of one of the greatest, like, public health achievements of all time in human history, and untethered from the stories like my grandmother. I remember my grandmother, with whom I was very close, talking about how she waited in line for 6 hours to get her kids vaccinated against polio. And how excited she was that my mother and her brothers could now safely swim in the pool in the summer. So I was like, what happened to these stories that probably were being told in lots of families? So it's like not the evidence and it's not the stories. But thankfully, there are a lot of smart people who can try to help us move forward again to a place where we have a common appreciation for what actual evidence is and how we should think about applying it to our lives, and a common sense of actual lived stories in our own lives and in our families. So I can either think, oh my gosh, like this is so depressing, and sometimes I do, but then I pick myself up and I'm like, that's not productive. I can think about, well, what can we do to try to learn from the people who are kind of at the vanguard of understanding what types of stories and what types of messaging and who the right storytellers are, to try to lend like our platform and our ecosystem, not only here in the United States, but around the world, because this is also clearly a global challenge. And so that's the solution space, because I do think it is the more moral space and place that I want to operate in.
Maybe please do think of questions. We'll open up for questions. But I have one point on that thread that I'd love to get your thoughts on. How can we, as a place that does science and at a high level, publish, everyone in this room is publishing papers and high impact journals and doing other work, and yet I have this sense that we're not really communicating it, or not communicating it perhaps as effectively as we could, or not partnering with organizations, foundations like yours in order to get the message out. Because like you said, there are so many things that for which there is just no evidence. But I have the sense that we, like so many other institutions, have on many levels lost trust. So how do we rebuild that trust? How do we become more effective? Not in a polemic way, but just communicating what we know, and perhaps equally importantly, what we don't know when we don't know something.
I mean, I think in some ways, you know, the answers are embedded, you know, in the way that you ask the question. I think there's a few challenges historically that I think we saw kind of acutely in the ways in which kind of the incentives and the culture of academia were arguably like not well suited to kind of the moment that we lived through in the last few years, right? I think I haven't really thought about this, so forgive me if it's a bit of a ramble, but my visceral reactions are a fewfold. You know, one, the sense of kind of you do work, you submit a paper for publication, and then you're on to the next thing. Instead of thinking like, how do I more broadly communicate, you know, what we now have a good evidence basis for. But I'm sure the way most of your kind of lab or practice funding works is like you're so oriented to the next thing. So trying to understand, I think, that time dimension. I think too, in a wonderful way, I saw one of my really good friends last night, who is a researcher at Harvard, who runs a big lab, and she spent so much time telling me like what she didn't know. It's understandable, like part of what you do is to be mindful of what you don't know, to hopefully ask like better questions, you know, over the next horizon. But I think when we're living in a moment of like 15 second sound bites, and it's something like, you know, teenagers, the alpha generation, you know, are willing to watch things of like 22 second duration. If the preamble is all of like what we don't know, all they think is like, well, you don't know anything. Instead of saying, well, here's what we know and here's what we don't know, and here's how we think it applies to your life. Like, I'm trusting you, like, you know, to be able to use this information in whatever way you think applicable to make the decisions for yourself and your family. But I think there is this sense of like, oh my gosh, we don't know so much, because I think you're always focused on like, well, what is the, like, how do I narrow the space of what I don't know? So I think I would hope maybe you could think about that. And the third thing I would say too is, you know, respectfully, Dean Minor, like you just talked about like all of the really prestigious places where like your colleagues are publishing, and clearly that's important. Like, I believe in the peer review model. I believe in the ways in which kind of the artifacts of knowledge help, again, like build the kind of, you know, the skeleton of us hopefully ever better understanding ourselves and our world. But we should also have incentives, recognitions in place for people who publish in Parents Magazine.
Sure.
Or the AARP Magazine, which is still the most widely read magazine in the entire world. Did you know that? It is. If you are a member of AARP, you get in the mail a copy of the magazine. And I was just with the AARP policy team last month. It is true that they think millions of AARP members read the magazine cover to cover every issue, and that tens of millions of readers read at least one article. So I think we just have to think about how we hopefully celebrate people who are helping us better understand our world, help the rest of us better understand ourselves and our environments as they are today, and what hopefully can help us all be kind of healthier and better off in the future. But I think that has to come probably from the top.
Great.
I mean, you asked.
Absolutely. Great. Chelsea, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your optimism, your vision for the
future.
My
honesty, Dean Miner, to you. Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone.
It's great. Thank you. Great. This is wonderful.
Thank you for listening to the Miner Consult with me, Stanford School of Medicine Dean Lloyd Miner. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion with author and global health advocate Chelsea Clinton. Please send your questions by email to theminorconsult@theminorconsult.com and check out our website, theminorconsult.com, for updates, episodes, and more. To get the latest episodes of The Miner Consult, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate the podcast 5 stars. Your feedback helps make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to our next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and be kind.